You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Our topic today is really interesting. It's about literary Louisiana. Of course, there's always emphasis in New Orleans, but there's a scene throughout Louisiana, too. We want to talk about some of the main characters from Louisiana's past, and I guess some of the emerging people. With me today is Peggy Scott Labord, who's a producer for WYS Channel 12 in New Orleans, and who recently did a documentary called Literary New Orleans, and she'll tell us where you can find it. It's been shown in there's various sites where you can pick it up. It's really worth seeing. It's just a good encyclopedia of the literary scene. So, hi, Peggy. First of all, let me ask you, you look familiar to me.
Well, you know, I go by another name on occasion, you know, Mrs. Errol Labord. So that could be why.
So you're that, well, you're that kind of blonde hair. Yeah. Okay, I got you. Okay.
But you see a lot.
Okay. Let's talk about some people. I guess The first three I want to talk about is Tennessee Williams and Nan Rice and John Kennedy Toole. I guess over time that Tennessee Williams is the most famous. Now, he's not from Tennessee. He's not from Louisiana. He was born in Missouri, right?
No. He was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi, but his family spent a lot of time in St. Louis, hence
spent his time. So what brought him to New Orleans?
Oh, well, the whole connection to the perception of New Orleans at the time, and this is in the mid to late 30s, it was inexpensive to live. You were accepted there regardless of your sexual proclivity, shall we say. All right. And so,
and he wasn't quiet about his sexual proclivity.
No, not at all.
He said in New Orleans is where he, what was his words?
He discovered the decadent world of New Orleans.
Okay.
But it was a real sexual freedom, which was not certainly something in most other American cities, you know, especially at the time. But it was also beautiful. And you know, let's not forget, well, first of all, inexpensive rent and the subtropical nature of the city, too. It's a beautiful place visually, and also the weather's nice most of the time. That's not necessarily the case in St. Louis.
And he also thought he might have a job possibility here.
Yes, and it's funny how all that is intertwined. Lyle Saxon was the editor of both the Works Progress Administration Travel Guide to New Orleans. They were doing this around the country in major cities, and to Louisiana. So he was a busy bee, and Saxon was very well known, very respected for his books with regional topics. But it was a very big deal for that to be here. If you read, they've been reprinted many times, especially the New Orleans one. And if you read that even today, you know, it's incredible how some things have not changed.
This was in the recession that preceded World War II.
Right.
Of course, at the time, they didn't know it was preceding World War II, but they did. And the Roosevelt administration needed to create jobs, and so they created jobs, federally funded jobs.
Some
of them were like building bridges and building highways and building roads. The lucky ones got to be in the Writers Project, where they just wrote books.
It was called the Federal Writers Project, and they just really did a great job. And it's also chock full of fascinating photos of the time. And one thing to really point out is that Saxon was brilliant about hiring a gentleman named Marcus Christian, who was a black poet and a journalist, and he was tasked with creating a team of black New Orleans writers. And so you've got a lot of wonderful windows on the culture of black New Orleans of the day, and that's not the case in most of the other city guidebooks around the country.
And Christian himself wrote a book about talk about an unusual topic, about Negro iron workers in New Orleans. These are the guys that work, like, on the wrought iron that you see in the balconies.
Yes.
So that was, I guess, primarily a black specialty occupation, and he wrote about that.
You know, much later, so we're talking the late 30s, but in the 70s, he actually was a writer in residence and teacher at the University of New Orleans. I'm sorry, I never had a class with him. But he was also a very, very well thought of as a poet, too.
Actually, I once had a chance to interview him when I was doing research on Mardi Gras. And the research was on the doing something on the balls in the black community. And he followed that scene. He really followed that scene. And he told me, what differences are there? He said he noticed that in the early days of the black balls, that the girls tended to have more standard, I guess, European style dress and all that. But that was changing, especially at that time, where there was more of an Afro emphasis on things, and so that the girls were starting to look differently at the balls now. I don't know if you'd have the same judgment today, but he really was an important person. Anyway, Tennessee Williams. So he was interested in that Writers Project. So that might have a lot to do with Brigham Young, but he didn't get the job.
He didn't get the job, but he stayed here nevertheless because of all of the reasons, we just cited. He, though, was very poor at the time. I mean, this is way before Glass Menagerie and Streetcar, of course. And so in that poverty, he talks about on our show, we have this wonderful, really exclusive interview that Eric Paulson, Channel 4's very own Eric Paulson, did in the early 80s when he was a co-host and a senior producer for PM Magazine. And so we get to use this interview, and thanks to Eric and Channel 4. But what Tennessee talks about is he had to hock a borrowed typewriter, a fraternity pin. That's poor. Mm-hmm. That's when things are a little on the tough side. He had something called jodhpurs, which are a kind of pants that you wear when you're taking riding lessons, horse riding, equestrian lessons. He had those too. Things were a little on the tough side. But this is, of course, when he's working on a play called Angel in the Alcove. He's working on lots of different plays, and not too soon after, he Glass Menagerie. But then he kept coming back to New Orleans. That's the other thing, and that's why they're walking tours. And one of them was originally created by Dr. Kenneth Holich. He lived in different places. He was renting apartments. Now, in the early 80s, he bought a house on Dumaine Street. But up until that time, he was renting apartments. But even when he became famous and wealthy, he would come back here.
Now, it was in one of those apartments, a small apartment, where he was working on a play called The Poker Night.
Exactly.
So what happened to that? Like, you don't hear much about it.
Yeah, well, there's a reason. First of all, the address, 632 St. Peter Street, which is right next to the gumbo shop.
Okay.
All right. And he is in the top attic apartment with this amazing skylight. And yes, the play is called The Poker Night, and there are characters named Blanche and Stella. Originally, Stanley's name was Ralph, but he said he could hear that rattle-trap old streetcar, going down one, side street and up the other. Well, that was the streetcar named Desire, which incredibly, the year after he wrote A Streetcar Named Desire, which he ultimately changed the name of the play to, the streetcar line itself was discontinued. So timing is everything.
And he described, these aren't the exact words, but he described changing the name to Streetcar Named Desire, that choice is the perfect metaphor for the condition of life.
Yeah, because, of course, Blanche, one of the earliest lines in the play, they told me to take a streetcar named Desire, transfer to one called Cemeteries. The words Desire and Cemeteries, and then get off at Elysian Fields, the afterlife. These are all metaphors, for the human condition in life.
Yeah, people don't know that the term Elysian Fields was a term for afterlife.
Yes, about the afterlife in mythology.
And so you're going from cemeteries to afterlife to the Elysian Fields.
Yeah. And then a P.S. to this is that 632 St. Peter, uh-huh. Stanley and Stella's address is 632 Elysian Fields.
Okay, wow. And so he had he wrote Streetcar in New Orleans, things like Cat on the Hot Tin Roof. Did they write all the major plays in New Orleans?
I can't say for sure if he was writing that. But he wrote a lot of the early plays. Angel in the Alcove wasn't a big hit, but some of these early plays then get morphed into something else, So it's very interesting to see. He has an idea for a play here, and then eventually it turns into something else. Now, a play that he wrote later in his life called Vieux Carré is really pretty much almost a theatrical memoir of some of those early memories in which he is renting this room, you know, like in a rooming house, and he's in the attic apartment, which, by the way, is 722 St. Excuse me, Toulouse Street, which is owned by the Historic New Orleans Collection today. I've actually been up to the top where that room was, and now it's their HVAC place because it was really teeny tiny. But he was writing earlier plays there, so. He's always writing, and he's also, even when he completes a play, he's always rewriting it to the very, very end, and that's fascinating. And a case in point with Streetcar, they're actually the University of Texas in Austin, the Harry Ransom Collection, okay, archive. There are Tennessee Williams scripts, you know, typewritten scripts. And the endings were different. There were like three or four different endings for Streetcar, including Stanley and Blanche deserting Stella, who had just had the baby, you know. Mm. So there were all kinds of different possibilities.
I may get my people confused here, but I think Dick Cavett told a story about a famous writer at that time. And I forget which one it was, but who went to visit Tennessee Williams. And he went in and Williams was sitting by his typewriter, and he was just kind of like stalled for a moment. He says, "What's the matter, Tennessee?" And he says, "Well, I'm working on an ending for Streetcar." Now, by that time, Streetcar had been a play, okay? It had been on Broadway. It had been made to a movie. And there he was working on an ending for Streetcar. Yeah. Speaking of the movie, that was really, I mean, it's one thing to have a successful Broadway play, and I think winning a Pulitzer Prize, whatever it was.
Yes.
But then what really triggered that thing in his career and his reputation was the movie, because the movie itself, beyond the play itself, was something that people talk about forever.
Well, you know, during that time, most of these movies, the Hollywood movies were made like on the back lot, and, you know, in Los Angeles and Hollywood. There is a scene, though, that actually came to New Orleans briefly. And Vivian Leigh and Ilya Kazan, who was the director, who directed both the and he's known for On the Waterfront and so many other fine films, but he was also a theatrical director, and he directed the Broadway production of Streetcar. Anyway, so he and Vivian Leigh come to New Orleans, and they do film in what was Illinois Central Train Station, no longer there, of course, along the riverfront, kind of where the aquarium is today. Because there was a streetcar, and there was a sort of a roundabout. You know, the streetcar still does that today, goes around. And so they show her getting off of a train, which she's coming ostensibly from Mississippi, they lost Belle Reve. It was the plantation that she and her sister Stella owned, the family plantation. So she's homeless. So she gets off of the train, and then she asks, I think, a sailor, you know, could you tell me where I can get a streetcar? And then you see her going on a streetcar, and then there's a wide shot on Canal Street of the streetcar, you know, heading down Canal.
What did you think of the casting of Marlon Brando as Stanley?
Well, isn't he the, you know, penultimate Stanley? That's for sure. I mean, nobody else can really top that. It's always, you know, measured against that. There are some amazing photos. There was a very kind gentleman who sadly is deceased now. He was a retired teacher named Fred Todd, and he loved collecting Tennessee Williams memorabilia, and he has since donated them, his estate donated them to the Historic New Orleans Collection. And in them are production stills of a young Marlon Brando in various T-shirts, you know, trying to determine what's the best look. There's also a scrapbook, a photo scrapbook that was owned by Vivian Leigh of shots on the set while they're making the movie. And remember, she wasn't in the Broadway production. Jessica Tandy, a lot of people, that's like a great trivia question. Who, you know, was Blanche on Broadway? It was Jessica Tandy.
Now, Tennessee lived in a few different places. He lived in New York, and he had an apartment, and he died in New York in an apartment. And then in Key West, I think Key West was one of them. And in New Orleans, I think Key West and New Orleans are probably his favorite places.
Yes, he owned a cottage in Key West. You know, among the many talents of this gentleman, he fancied himself a painter. And so he was kind of like a naive painter. And so there are paintings, and he did a lot of that in Key West. But he loved coming back to New Orleans. Before he owned a place, he would also stay at the Mont Lyon Hotel. And the Mont Lyon is a whole other story because a lot of writers gravitated toward the Hotel Mont Lyon.
One place that he hated, I think the word he used was loathe, was St. Louis.
Yes,
Which is, of course, where his family was from, but he had no interest in St. Louis. I think St. Louis had no interest to him.
Well, his mom, you know, was from Clarksdale, from Mississippi, Miss Edwina. He had a brother and a sister, and his sister's name was Rose, and his brother was Dakin. And Errol, as you know, we got to know Dakin pretty well. This was his baby brother, as he was called, and who had amazing stories, and he was larger than life himself, but he would come to a lot of Tennessee Williams festivals annually. But Rose, very unfortunately, had mental issues as she grew up. But Tennessee Williams adored her, and in every play, the story goes that in every play by Tennessee Williams, there is some reference to a rose, the obvious rose tattoo. But even if it's not in the title, it might be in a stage direction. Like, for instance, it might say, and there must be a rug, you know, in the living room with a rose on it, something like that.
And even, as I recall, even on his... on his tombstone marker, there's an image of in St. Louis. He was born in St. Louis, which would have really just ticked him off if you'd known that, okay, in Calvary Cemetery, where he is almost ignored. It's almost impossible to find his place. Now, if he had been buried in St. Louis, number 2 in New Orleans, I mean, there'd be tour buses lined up right there. But in St. Louis, he's pretty much ignored.
Yeah. Very underappreciated there, very appreciated here.
Yeah. When he died, the official reason that was given was because I think he was taking medication, and he choked on the bottle cap.
Asphyxiation. Yeah, the bottle cap.
And that was what the coroner said, and that was what a lot of people said. But one person who didn't say that was his brother Dakin. To Dakin's dying day, he insisted that Tennessee was assassinated. He was killed. That somebody arranged to have him choked.
Yes. Well, he maintained that a woman named the Lady Maria Saint-Just, who ultimately became the executor of Tennessee Williams' will, somehow made that arrangement. And, of course, there's nothing to substantiate that. But he was always afraid that she was going out for him to get him. So as you will recall, in one of the visits to New Orleans during the festival, he actually had a bodyguard. So
he had an entourage toward the end.
He did have an entourage, too.
You see, okay.
Yes, he did.
Even though if I wanted to attack Dakin, I wouldn't let his entourage stop me. It was not a fierce-looking entourage, remember that?
No.
Let's mention another person who has a really popular following in New Orleans, with Anne Rice.
That's for sure. That is for sure. She was, of course, as many know, she was born in New Orleans in the Irish Channel area, but as an adult ended up marrying a gentleman named Stan Rice, who was an English professor at San Francisco State and a poet. And so a lot of her adult life was spent, early adult life, was spent in San Francisco. Eventually, though, when her books started, she started writing books and they were taking off, they, you know, had garnered enough wealth to come back here. She had many houses, and they lived in one of them, in the Garden District specifically. One of her later series of novels, The Mayfair Witchers and The Witching Hour, is set in pretty much in the house where they lived on, I believe it's Chestnut First or something like that. Anyway, it was in the Garden District, a gorgeous, gorgeous house. But she came back in 1988. And she did a lot of writing here, but she was very kind. You know, of course, Vampire Lestat had come out in an interview with the Vampire in the late 70s. So she came back to New Orleans, and she had quite a following already.
And she was really interested in religion and saints and cemeteries. And
of course, she grew up Catholic.
Yeah, of course, in New Orleans, there's a motherlode of that kind of stuff to look at, you know. And she wrote a book about the saints.
Well, that was more about the Creole of Color community, but that was called Feast of All Saints.
Okay.
And let me say, that is one of those unheralded books in terms of the best known of Vampire, of course. But if anybody is interested, and they should be, about the gens de couleur, the Creole of Color community in the 1840s, which was very much a part of the community and very underappreciated. She did a lot of research on it, and it's a fascinating book. I highly recommend it.
Now, in your documentary, you have an interview, a priceless interview with Anne Rice, in which, as I recall, she's talking about one night just being home and sitting down at a typewriter and writing, and she was wondering what it would be like to interview a vampire and to ask, what's it like being a vampire? Okay.
To take life.
And was it like having killed someone? And to do that, so she got this idea about interviewing a vampire. And she says, once she starts writing, she almost can't stop. It just keeps on flowing. So it's a spontaneous thing, but it really...
It started off as a short story. She was applying for a short story competition, so she wanted to do that. But eventually it grew. But she does talk about this. Thankfully, this was recorded at the 1989 Tennessee Williams Festival. Dr. Kenneth Holdidge conducted the interview. He did a great job. Long time, unfortunately, late English professor. But she really talks about such... you know, enthusiasm with such vigor of the process, because I think she was still stunned about how spontaneous, of course, you know, a lot to do with her vast talents, about how she really got into it. But she even talked about, like, sometimes she wasn't even sure where one character was, you know, going out the door and the other one was coming in, that it was almost like she was sort of possessed, if you will.
Here, too, it was made into a movie.
Absolutely. And then, of course, also a recent, feature series for cable.
Now, she lived after the time when her work started to become popular. She lived in Los Angeles most of the time, but she did have a home in New Orleans.
Yes. She came from San Francisco to New Orleans. Okay. But then her son, Chris, who pretty much grew up in New Orleans, but he moved back to California. And so she ended up living near La Jolla, is my understanding, because she wanted to be near him. Unfortunately, and this sort of is part of the Anne Rice saga, is that they had a little girl, I believe her name was Michelle, and she died when she was about 8 or 9 years old. And that Michelle, it's almost a tribute to Michelle, the character that's in Interview with the Vampire, the poor little girl who can't grow up because she was made a vampire as a child.
Oh, wow. Another person, John Kennedy Toole. Mm. Now, of all the people we talk about, this is the one person whose life story could qualify to make a movie in itself.
Well, that's in the works, my understanding.
I know they've been talking about it for years.
It really is in the
years,
works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know one time they're talking about what John Belushi is in, but by now, I mean, it would, in the right hands, would make a good movie. But let's go to the basics of it. Here you got this young writer, not well known. He was teaching at Loyola at the time.
Dominican College.
Okay. Uh-huh. And he goes to his mom and shows her this transcript of a thing that he wrote. His mom, Thelma, lived in New Orleans, an eccentric woman, eccentric in college.
Larger than life, yes.
But what happened from there?
Well, very sadly, he committed suicide.
And, but you jumped ahead. I mean, okay. What happened?
Well, he's telling his mom that he's writing it, okay? Yeah. And what happened was he was teaching locally, and then he joined the Army. And so he was in Puerto Rico, and he had more time in his off-duty time to write. And so he buys a typewriter, and he starts to write this novel. And when he comes back, he shows it to his mom. So his mom talks about starting to read it, okay? Well, I am skipping ahead because the tragedy is that he committed suicide, and so she's left with this novel. And she's trying and spends years trying to get it published, and then there's the whole saga of that, too. Should we continue with that?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so among the many efforts is she finds out that, of course, famed novelist Walker Percy is teaching a creative writing class at Loyola. And so she makes an appointment to go see him and brings the manuscript. And she had tried and tried with a lot of New York publishers to no avail. So she drops it off with him and she says, please, please help me get it published. And he did his darndest. He really did. And at the same time, that creative writing class included Walter Isaacson, Tim Gautreaux, Valerie Martin, who was a famed novelist. I mean, it was and Kenneth Holdidge. And so they all, Walker Percy shared, what had happened, that this woman, this rather eccentric woman, very, very larger than life, drops off this manuscript. And so he proceeds to start reading some of it to them, and they're just amazed how good it is. And so in their own way, they all try to help, in terms of spreading the word. But indeed, Walker Percy, makes a lot of efforts with his publisher, which was a New York publisher, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. They turned it down because the author was deceased. Anyway, he really tried to help her, and eventually he pitches it to LSU Press, and they say yes. Now, the irony of ironies here. Walker Percy was working on a novel while this was going on, which is called The Second Coming and would prove to be his last novel. When Confederacy comes out, it's a big, big hit, and it's up for the Pulitzer Prize. So is Second Coming, Walker Percy's, the same year. And as we well know what happens, Confederacy of Dunces wins.
Yeah, Walker Percy. Yeah.
So no good deed goes unpunished, something like that.
You know, that was a big step for LSU. That's not the kind of book a university press usually publishes. And for a university press to do that kind of book.
Yep, exactly. So it took a lot of courage. But you interviewed Mrs. Toole, and we saw her one night do a performance. She was an elocution teacher. She spoke extremely crisply and clearly. It was almost like she was in sort of impoverished gentility. She, at that point, was a widow. She lived in, a very modest cottage on Elysian Fields. There's Elysian Fields again. And it turns out that Kenneth Holditch became good friends with her. And he didn't know, but they lived three blocks away. So there are all kinds of sub-stories in this, too.
What I remember most about that interview, we'll always remember, is I think it was on a Sunday afternoon, but anyway, it was like a shotgun house. And she was a little scattered, and so was the shotgun house. It was a little messy and all that. But anyway, she was sitting down. We had a great conversation. But anyway, after it was over, I was about to leave. I said, Mr. Toole, let me ask you something. Where is John's Pulitzer Prize, the actual Pulitzer Prize? And she kind of stopped. And she kind of looked around a little bit, and she says, oh. She got up, says, I think it's here, okay. And she had this wingback chair, this stuffed wingback chair, you know, that you have and had all these papers and magazines, and she kind of went through them all, okay. At the very bottom was the Pulitzer Prize. It was in a certificate. Oh, here it is, you know. So there was the Pulitzer Prize and the wingback at the bottom of the trash and the wingback chair on Elysian Fields.
Well, E, one thing that I remember is that after your interview, when you came home, you were carrying a D.H. Holmes bag, okay? And at that point, D.H. Holmes had sadly closed down. The department store, of course, where the novel first begins, Under the Clock, at D.H. Holmes, and many of us locals, spent some time under the clock waiting for somebody to pick us up or whatever, or to meet friends. And it was some Russell Stover candy. She was very genteel, very polished.
And there was reference to it in the book about getting a mint from D.H. Holmes. And so I think she made her own.
She's very hospitable.
Her own privacy. I got to tell you, when she gave it to me, I didn't get it at first, okay?
Yeah.
No, it was very touching that she did that. And now let's get to the final scene that you made reference to. John Kennedy Toole is in Biloxi.
He ends his life. He ends his life. And of course, that was very hard for her. That was her only child.
Now he was in an automobile and he put like a hose in it or something like that.
It was suicide. He was very depressed because he'd been trying to get the novel published himself, for a long time. So, I mean, such tragedy there. Now, to back up a little bit, when he was 16, he wrote a novel called The Neon Bible. And that manuscript she actually, had an access to. She did not, while she was alive, she did not want to have it published because she felt it was inferior. But he was 16. People understand, the context of that. Here's something that's still brilliant. And she really didn't want to have it published. But some family members who apparently there were some financial squabbles, and they insisted that it get published. And I've read it, and actually I think it's pretty good.
And with that, the John Kennedy Toole legacy started, but it was really, the story behind it was so interesting, too.
Yeah. Well, you and I have talked about that book, and that it's very funny. I mean, it's really one of the few books that I ever read that makes you laugh out loud. How many books do that, It kind of goes off, E, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's kind of heresy to talk about, but when you first read it, the first few chapters are just unbelievable. Of course, the main character is Ignatius Riley, and he's really kind of this lumpy kind of guy who's kind of speak theatrically, and there's just...
the characters. I mean, there's so many. Darlene the Stripper.
He's an amazing character trying to find his own worldview in life. In those first few chapters, it's just really funny, and he sells our equivalent of Lucky Dogs. I forget what it was called, but he became that.
Santa Bataglia, his mom's friend.
And so that part of it is really funny. And then he kind of just... The later chapter kind of goes off in a different direction. Yeah. And it's not as entertaining of a book in the later part of it. But I think it's the first part of it that sold it. I mean, maybe the Pulitzer Committee looked at it and said, hey, man, this is good. I don't need to read any more.
It's just incredible how well it's, I think it's been translated into 20 different languages. So it has this universal appeal. To quote one of the experts that I talked to, T.R. Johnson, who's a professor at Tulane, you know, it's kind of a Don Quixote story. You know, Ignatius, if you haven't read the book, you know, is very snooty, and he feels he's better than everybody else. He is very well-read. He's into medieval scholarship. He's in his own world, and, you know, and so everybody else is pretty much too much trouble, right? But he's looking for something else, and quixotic would be the right term.
He worked at the pants factory.
Levy Pants, which is actually supposedly based on an actual pants factory, Rudder Rex, in what we call today Bywater.
And there was it still exists, a statue of Ignatius. Originally, it's in the building, in the entrance of the building that was D.H. Holmes.
It's right out front. It was done by a sculptor named Bill Ludwig. And it's actually based on the physical, the persona of John Spud McConnell, and who played on stage around town and actually around the state. He also performed it in Baton Rouge, Ignatius. The theater company in Baton Rouge was actually given permission to do a dramatized version, and John did that. Also, the Tennessee Williams Festival, once again, got permission to do a dramatized mini version of it, if you will, an excerpt, and Spud played that quite a few times.
Let's talk just about some of the people from around the rest of the state. Chopin,
who eventually lived in New Orleans, but eventually lived out of New Orleans in Clucherville. And she was certainly, you know, in Victorian days, you know, we're talking about the 1860s and 70s, you know, she was a free spirit. She would walk, you know, at that time women should have been accompanied by, you know, gentlemen. She walked around the city of New Orleans. She lived on Esplanade. She felt very free. She felt very encumbered in her role as a mom, and just really wrote about these kinds of things. She had some hard times because her husband was a little bit of a ne'er-do-well, which is most unfortunate, and he actually died fairly young. But because of some business reversals, they had to move away from New Orleans. But the house where she lived is still exists in Clucherville. Uh-huh.
In your documentary, you have a clip with Walter Isaacson, who, as I recall, he's about to leave town to go to some kind of book event, and he's talking to his daughter, and his daughter says, why are you going to this? He says, well, because, you know, I write books, and I'm going to do a book signing and all that. And she says, yeah, but Dad, you don't write novels. I mean, would you write as historical books?
You're not a real writer.
She says. And I think that feeling is there. I think some people think that unless you write novels, you're not a real writer, all right? Which
incredible
grates against me
right.
On a personal note. But they have some people who've written important works of history, like Stephen Ambrose, the books he's done in World War II. Band of Brothers has had a huge impact on the understanding of World War II. The book on Huey Long.
A.J. Liebling. T. Harry Williams.
T. Harry Williams, the LSU professor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A.J. Liebling did do a book about the politics on. And so, I mean, New Orleans, I mean, Louisiana is a rich field of stories to tell that don't need to rely totally on the imagination, but just reporting on, you know, accurately what happened. But there have been some good people that have come out of there.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, you have a lot of statewide writers. Tim Gautreaux is known for his novels, you know. James Lee Burke, my goodness, out of New Iberia, a lot of his detective series. I mean, Louisiana is, yeah, it's not just New Orleans. There's so many other writers, around the state as well. We could, the late Andre Debussy, that's we could have another show just on, not New Orleans writers, but the rest of the state.
Now, you also talk about a man named, people might be a little less familiar with him, Tom Dent.
Oh, yes. Well, Tom Dent was certainly of New Orleans, and he was involved with the civil rights struggle, was in the service, and then moved up to very well-educated. His dad was the president of Dillard University, so very refined, polished, academic family, brilliant family. And but he wants to find his way, and so he goes up to New York, and he actually meets a lot of renowned writers in this sort of renaissance of, not the Harlem Renaissance, because this is much later, but he gets to meet James Baldwin and a lot of, famous black writers. But he eventually ends up working for the NAACP. But tires of New York, comes back down to New Orleans and is a journalist, writes a lot of poetry. He writes a play, which to this day is often put on, called Ritual Murder, and sadly, with, New Orleans's crime problem and situation, poverty, is unfortunately, he wrote it almost 20 to 30 years ago, could be easily done today and is often repeated. But he was the executive director of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. He was really in touch with New Orleans culture, the Black Masking Indians. He was there. He was in the middle of it all. Very, very beloved.
Who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, Tennessee Williams. I mean, that, and Anne Rice. So, I sometimes with some of these programs, I guess I'm at my own focus group, but I also ask other people, what they think should be included too. But I would say probably Tennessee Williams, just because even today when you're reading his work, it's like, this is such a beautiful sentence. How could you come up with this? So I guess that's the quick answer. But I also read a lot of nonfiction, just because of the work that I do in terms of history, but a lot of local history. I would say today, though, Richard Campanella, let's talk about that, Larry Powell, who have written about the New Orleans cityscape of past and present. I mean, we could go on for days about that. They're such gifts to the community.
Ethan, actually, he's been a guest on this podcast. He's really an important writer.
Is he ever?
Okay. The kind of things he's doing, identifying neighborhoods and the history behind the neighborhoods. And it's.
I also, as you well know, very interested in New Orleans jazz. And so somebody like Tommy Sancton, who is the son of a novelist,
and
Tom
Sancton.
Who we've
also had the guest on this podcast.
Yes, yeah. Tommy, sort of grew up at Preservation Hall, and he was not only a journalist and the Paris bureau chief for Time magazine at one point, but he wrote about sort of his own memoirs of growing up as a teenager in Preservation Hall and learning the clarinet from, these incredible jazz musicians, including George Lewis. So I like that he's writing about that, because that's what I'm interested in, traditional jazz in New Orleans.
What is, I know in your documentary, you also deal with the literary scene in New Orleans. Talk about the bookstores and the things that are out
there. Yes, I do. Talk about the past and present. Let me just quickly say another really important period is the 1920s. Because that is also, it's inexpensive to live, come to the quarter, those kinds of things. You have these group of writers who are encouraging other writers to come to town, including William Faulkner. He was only here for 6 months, but he did so much. And of course, Faulkner House Books, which is one of these great little bookstores in Pirates Alley, that's where he lived. He lived on the second floor there. But a lot of these people, came to town early on. La Saxon was kind of part of the scene. Robert Penn Warren actually had an apartment, even though he was teaching at LSU, he had an apartment in the quarter. And it's a pretty long list. The Double Dealer was this literary magazine that was published locally. And people like Hemingway were published in the magazine. It was incredible. But anyway, today, yes, we have a very vibrant literary scene.
Let me get back to that, because that line of conversation just reminded me of someone we hadn't talked about, we need to, is Truman Capote.
Absolutely, yes. We're talking about in the late 30s. That's fascinating. So the 20s are vibrant, and then the mid to late 30s are. But here's Truman Capote, who comes to New Orleans. It's inexpensive. He stays at a place at 7-Eleven Royal. He starts working on what becomes his first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms. And that is considered one of the earliest novels, and it was on the bestseller list, New York Times bestseller list. But the theme is gay. It's LGBTQ. It's one of the earliest works of literature and fine literature coming out of New Orleans with focusing specifically on that topic. He becomes friends with Tennessee Williams. There's crossover there. A later book, Chameleons, Place for Chameleons, that is dedicated to Tennessee Williams. But someone else that you wouldn't expect who adopted the city and loved it and really brought much acclaim to it was Frances Parkinson Kyes. And her house, 1113 Chartist, BK House as it's called now, she wrote over 50 books, but one of them was called in the 1940s, it was a real bestseller, it was a murder mystery. And we're talking about Dinner at Antoine's. And if I could, the story goes that that book is really hot. And, of course, I'm sure it helped Antoine's, one of New Orleans' most storied restaurants. But when a young Owen Brennan, who really is the sort of progenitor of the Brennan family way back when, he is about to open a restaurant, and he sees that, this book, Dinner of Antoine's, and he was very publicity savvy. And he's trying to figure out what to do. You got to have a gimmick in addition to having a fine restaurant. So he's about to open Brennan's, which sadly he dies before it gets open. And so his siblings really march on, and later his sons. But Ella Brennan is very much a part of all that, and on Royal Street. And so a friend tells him, a travel writer friend tells him, well, wait a minute. If there's dinner at Antoine's, how about breakfast at Brennan's? And, of course, the rest is history.
Famous story about Owen Brennan, if I remember when he was... He had a bar, I think, in the quarter. And
yes, the Absinthe House.
He told somebody he wanted to open a restaurant, and he was going to open a French restaurant. And whoever it was kind of defied, how can an Irishman open a French restaurant successful?
He grew up, in the Irish Channel. He was of a very humble origin and did very, very well. But he started out as a liquor salesman.
Back to Truman Capote for a second, because we were talking about the thing between the novelist and nonfiction. The work that he was probably best remembered for was work of nonfiction. In Cold Blood.
Mm-hmm. But Music for Chameleons, which I alluded to earlier, in Cold Blood, of course, is his most famous. And let's not forget Breakfast at Tiffany's, too, But later on, one of the last books, it was sort of a compilation of essays and a very long, short story. Music for Chameleons talks about later, he'd come back and forth to New Orleans. He didn't have a house here, but he would rent an apartment, or he'd stay at the Mont Lyon, too. But it talks about, hanging out in Jackson Square and the characters and all this stuff. But that book he did dedicate to Tennessee Williams.
You mentioned the Mont Lyon a few times. Did the Mont Lyon become kind of like a writer's hangout?
It did. And, you had that Carousel Bar. That was, pretty fascinating, too. But, yes, the hotel's very proud of its literary heritage. That's for sure. But today, if we just talk about today's scene, a lot of people are publishing nationally. We talked about Walter Isaacson, even though he doesn't live here, but he comes back and forth. Michael Lewis, of course, these are really, we're talking about nonfiction writers. The list is really long. Let's talk about biographers. Pat Brady wrote, of course, about Rachel Jackson and Martha Washington. Nigel Hamilton. Has written many World War II biographies, and they live here. And the list is long. Pulitzer Prize winners, Buku, Richard Ford lives here, and he's written, and not all of his books are set in New Orleans by any means, but he has chosen to live here.
You mentioned Pat Brady. I'm sure a lot of people aren't familiar with her, but
they should be.
I've lucky to have known her, but anyway. And she's done some books about prominent women in history. But a really interesting story that nobody really knows is she did the book on, as you mentioned, about Martha Washington. And the problem was that nobody knew what Martha Washington looked like. I mean, there's a picture of her as an older woman, kind of like a grandmamont type of person. But if a woman at the age when she was marrying or courting George or whatever, no one knew that. And so she actually hired someone like a forensic expert or somebody.
Yes, they call the lady, and I can't think of her name, but she's known as the Bone Lady.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Who knew those kind of things and who kind of just put together with bits of evidence they have at the time on what Martha Washington would look like. Was she in the 30s at the time? And that's the
cover. She was a widow. She had been a widow.
And that's a beautiful image, but that's the cover of the book. That image, that reworked image of what she would have looked like at that time.
And let me just say that the artist lives in New Orleans, Michael Deese, who's a prominent, a very nationally known artist, and he does a lot of stamps, U.S. postage stamps, and he did the Tennessee Williams stamp, but he was commissioned by Patricia Brady, to do this younger, you know, version of Martha Washington based on, you're right, you know, this forensic research, which was pretty amazing. But Michael, D-E-A-S, Michael
Deese. And I understand that that portrait is at Mount Vernon.
It is. Okay. Yes, so yes.
What people see of that. An image of Martha Washington as a younger woman was the result of Pat Brady working on her own and just commissioning that. What a great contribution to history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you can imagine, you know, the show, our documentary, Literary New Orleans, is 1 hour. And may I just say, if you want to know more about it, you can go to the WYES.org website. It's up on YouTube for the next few weeks, and it's also on PBS Passport, which is part of the WYES info.
So if somebody's listening to this a year from now, where would they find this?
Probably at that point at WYES Passport. Or we also have DVDs. Remember DVDs?
Okay.
If you want one, you can, you know, do that too. But this is a good deal right now that you can watch it on YouTube. WYES has a YouTube channel. So you go to YouTube, you type in WYES, and then you type in Literary New Orleans, and you can see it uninterrupted.
Yeah, that's a big thing, too. yeah, seeing uninterrupted. So
Thank
you very much. It's great work, okay? I have it on inside authority that you put many long hours working on this.
Thank you. And may I also plug a weekly arts and entertainment overview called Steppin' Out on Thursday nights at 7.
Okay, Peg, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, E.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.